that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Labor Radio, hosts Lane Ponce and co-host Susan Stoner interview author and activist Sharif Abdullah on creating a world that works for all.
Good day. This is Lane Ponce at Labor Radio, KBOO's fifth Monday. And I have guests with me today. My regular co-host, Susan Stoner, is here with me. And our guest is Sharif Abdullah, who will be talking about some of his work with a union, as well as some literary work he's been putting out. And he has a brand new book that is the second volume of, he will be talking about two volumes. So Susan, why don't you go ahead and ask Sharif about the union that you're familiar with?
Hey, well, Sharif, Lane told me that you've been very busy working with IBEW on inclusivity issues. And so I'm very interested in that because my family was a lifelong supporter of IBEW, both as an employer, oddly enough, and as union electricians, which is what IBEW is. So I kind of would like to know what you can tell us about the kinds of things that the union is looking to do, which would up their inclusivity.
Yeah, so from my perspective, my consulting client is NECA IBEW, because these two organizations, NECA being the National Electrical Contractors Association, they would be the owners and managers. And IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, would be the labor workers. They have decided to actually merge together to end their adversarial relationship and to recognize that they're all pulling in the same direction in toward a common goal. Now, so the question is, in that environment where you've got where you're doing away with the adversarial nature of the relationship and recognizing the relational nature of the relationship, how do you go about doing that? How do you go about forging a whole new dynamic in the context of the world we live in right now, which is fraught with adversarial relationships? So how do we bring together a better, more perfect union, if you want to get constitutional about it, and how do we start reflecting a new reality? So that's basically what I've been looking at.
So you come in as a consultant and help them with, because you've had lots of experience as a consultant with these kind of groups. Give me a little bit of your background as far as the work you've done all over the world.
So a little bit of background is, since we're all really good friends here, I will confess that I am a lawyer. I haven't practiced in years. I've been involved in various struggles over the years. Started out at 11 years old in Camden, New Jersey, the worst city in America, doing demonstrations for better housing for Black rights, etc., and against police brutality. And I had an opportunity to actually start seeing the rest of the world. So I'm up to 45 different countries I've been to on every continent that has people on it. And to be able to see the nature of our problems, and then therefore to be able to see the nature of our solutions. We know, I know, and I can think we can see that the problems that we have are not resting in the adversarial relationships that we've been taught. And what we have to do is start looking for and finding solutions that actually bring people together and not have one group trying to triumph over another.
Now, this is the kind of work that you do with Common Way. Is that the name of your organization? Could you tell us a little bit about that organization and how long you've been involved in it and when it got started, please?
Yeah, well, I formed Common Way, maybe 35 years ago. And then there was another organization that came before Common Way that's, again, the same principles. But the bottom line of our vision, our mission, our goals, and the title of one of my books is creating a world that works for all. How do we create a world that works for all living beings out of the mess that we've got right now, which is a world that doesn't work for literally any living beings, including the people it purports to work for? So we have this notion that the world works for white privileged males, the world works for rich, et cetera. And then when you talk to these white privileged males, when you talk to the rich, you find the world isn't working for them either. And so rather than trying to find a group to blame, rather than trying to make yourself a victim, the Common Way approach is to recognize that all of us are impacted by what we've got, and all of us will benefit through the creation of a new system. And that system is where it has to be based on not money, not a particular kind of social relationship, but really to be based on all of us, all living beings, not just human beings, but all living beings. And how do all of us find things like fulfillment, the benefit of all life, et cetera.
Susan, you did a little research online of Sharif, right? Did you have any questions about the Common Way that you ran across while you were looking them up?
Listening to what Sharif is saying, it really resonates with what Native American sensibility is, a communal responsibility that encompasses, well, in their case, it was usually a tribe, it wasn't all humanity, but it still is that communal responsibility that seems to be the alternative to the individualism. And so it's sort of an indigenous, I don't think it's particular to Native Americans. I think all indigenous people seem to have found that was the way to survive. So it, to me, what Common Way is doing makes sense.
Yeah. So you're right. In my travels in 45 different countries, I've probably encountered 120, 140 different cultures. Some people, when they travel around the world, they just travel in their own culture all around the world. That's what most Americans do. But I stepped out of my culture, and I've experienced indigenous people everywhere from 60 degrees south for the Maoris in New Zealand to 60 degrees north to indigenous people in Russia, people who have white skins, blue eyes, live in yurt tents, milk their yaks. I mean, it's and all of those people have a similar set of values. They value humanity, they value the earth, and they value relationships.
Now, can I interrupt for just a second? One thing I wanted to ask before I forget. One of the things I learned in studying about Native Americans is the greatest sin that you could do as a Native American was lie. And I thought that was a very interesting observation. And the reason was is because it was considered a tearing of their social fabric. Did you find that to be true?
Well, one of the things in terms of people, in my book, Creating a World That Works for All, I call that mentality, that consciousness, the keeper consciousness. And by keeper, I mean the people who keep to the sacred hoop, the people who keep their trust with each other, with themselves, with each other, with the earth herself, and in all relationships. And you can't keep that if you're lying, if you are saying something that simply is not true to who you are. The only way that you can even think about lying is when I start objectifying you. I start saying, I'm over here and you're over there. That breaks the connection between us. And at that point, I can do anything I want to do to you, including lie to you, including enslave you, including kill you. Now, all of those levels of beings, enslaving people, killing them, etc., comes from a kind of consciousness. That consciousness in my book I call the breaker consciousness, the people who break the sacred hoop, the people who say, I don't live with the earth, I live on top of the earth, and the earth is basically my piggy bank, my cesspool, and my playground, and after that I don't care anything about it. And so our challenge is, how do we develop a relationship with ourselves first? Okay, how do I develop a relationship with myself so that I don't lie to myself? How do I develop a relationship with you and with all others, including the people I call other, so that I can always be an authentic person in whatever environment I'm in?
So your work you carry out through Common Way Institute, right? Is it an institute or Common Way?
Common Way Institute.
And one of the things you're doing is you're launching this set of books, volume one and volume two, and it is basically futuristic science fiction. Would you call it that? Or how would you label the genre?
It's really hard. The technical term is science fiction, but there's not a whole lot of science in there. I like Neal Stephenson's reference. He calls it speculative fiction.
Speculating
about what our future is looking like. So I've written a number of books. They've all been nonfiction books. And this is my first foray into actually any form of fiction. And the core thought is that the world makes it, humanity makes it, and makes it through the next 100 years. Now, that is not the default option. The default option is that we're all toast. We're going down. And we're going down in a number of different ways. Anyway, so through the next 100 years, humanity makes it, and makes it in such a way that we've managed to get beyond all of our problems. We get beyond things like violence, things like war, things like, you know, pandemics, hunger, etc. So these people 100 years from now said, we need to chronicle how we got through all this. So they commission a study, and the study starts 100 years in their past, which is 2025. And they start looking at what happened for that 100 years to get us to this place where the world actually works for all. So the first one of the books gets us through the first 20 or 30 years, and it's called The Chronicles of the Upheavals. It's really focused on all of the crap that's about to hit us. And it all hits at once. It's not like we deal with a pandemic and then we deal with a financial crisis and then we deal with a political crisis. It all happens at once. To the point that our institutions are no longer reliable. You can't rely on the institutions anymore. Everybody basically is sitting back waiting for some level of institution to tell them what to do, not working. And when that collapses, when the economic system collapses, when the political system collapses, we human beings are thrown back on our own resources and our own values. Now, if my value is me first, screw you, you can predict what my behavior is going to be. If my value is we are creating a earth, creating a world that works for all living beings, that'll tell you again what my values are going to be. So all this is fed by my experiences around the world. I was in Russia when their political system collapsed, when the former USSR, the second largest superpower in the world, disappeared overnight. Just pop, this gone, and what's left in its wake is a third world country. We in America, that can't happen here. Guess what? It can happen. I was in Argentina when the economic system collapsed overnight. The banking system collapsed so think about this right now, and for everybody listening to this, think about it. All the money people had was what was in their pocket, because all the money that you had in the bank disappeared, gone forever, gone not until the bank can get its act together, gone forever. So what do you do? When I was in Buenos Aires, I watched formerly middle-class people pulling through the garbage cans of their neighbors looking for something to eat. I saw this by the thousands. Now, I'm not talking about a newscast I saw. I'm not talking about something I saw on television, etc. I saw this with my own eyes. Now, we could do this here. I was in Cuba when people were telling me how in their special period, they were eating each other's dogs. This one guy said, I can't eat my own dog, but I staked it out in the yard, knowing my neighbor was going to come over the fence and kill and eat my dog because I killed and ate his dog. Now, we don't think that kind of stuff can hit us. We think that because we're Americans, we're immune. We're not. And we will need each other. In fact, we're going to need the people that we're protesting against. We're going to need them if we're going to survive. And at some point in time, we're going to figure that out. That's all the first book.
Yes, yes. And it sounds
it gets
like
a little better from there.
Well, you know, it sounds like there must be some optimism in it, in that we somehow managed to stumble through the first 100 years onto the second book. And what is the name of the second book? We've got about 8 minutes left, and my audience is listening to KBOO, Sharif Abdullah, who is talking about his two books, and he's about to launch into a brief encounter with the second book. And the name of the second book is what?
Okay, so the first book was Chronicles of the Upheavals. Second book is Chronicles of the Awakening. So
nice.
We're picking up in 40 years after the beginning of the upheavals, and we're pretty much figuring out how we're going to survive. What we're recognizing now is that we need to awaken and awaken to a whole new level of being, awaken to a whole new level of consciousness. Because all of our problems are rooted in consciousness, therefore all of our solutions must be rooted in consciousness. And we start looking at what does human consciousness actually mean? Most of us in this society walk through life in a fairly unconscious way. We don't think about the consequences of what we do and what we say. What we're doing in the second Chronicles of the Awakening, what we're doing there is looking at how do people start the process of being awakened human beings on an awakening planet, recognizing that we're not the only beings on the planet who are intelligent. We're not the only beings on the planet who are awakened. The notion that we are the only intelligent species, or even the most intelligent species, comes from that consciousness that says, I'm better than you. I'm separate from you and I'm better than you. I will find some way to say that I'm better than you. Remember, these are the same people that thought that Black people and that women didn't even have a consciousness. No sense in you voting, no sense in you being part of the society because you don't even have a consciousness. Now we're recognizing that, and I recognize in the second book, in the Chronicles of the Awakening, that there are all sorts of levels of consciousness. If you recognize that crows are conscious, if you recognize that dolphins and whales not only are conscious, not only are intelligent, but probably are more intelligent than we are. They gave up fighting a long time ago. So in the Chronicles of the Awakening, we as human beings start for the first time in our history acting like a species.
Can I ask something here? What was the turning point? Was it it just got so awful, or was there a turning point in your story where?
Yes, and it's a two-pronged turning point. Number one, when you're on the Titanic and your feet are starting to get wet, you start realizing that we got to do something different. Okay, so things are getting bad. But also there was a group of people in the book called the Imaginal Group. And they started saying, all of this is not, the problem is that we, the caterpillar, are turning into we, the butterfly. How do we cooperate with this turning? My friend Joanna Macy wrote a book called The Great Turning. Well, there's a great turning going on, and we are about to enter into our butterfly being, the butterfly way of being.
Now, when you say that, do you mean we now, or this relationship to your book, or both?
Both.
Ah, good.
That's what we, Common Way, my organization, when I'm not writing fiction, that's what we are trying to do is bring
right. And you have workshops and online trainings about how to resolve conflicts in an awakened way? Is that correct? How yes, would indeed. You describe it?
Well, the work that we describe, that I describe, is inclusivity. Inclusivity being the recognition I am connected to you, that we are one, and that from that connection, we need to start to start behaving and acting. So many of the actors, the people who think of themselves as changing society, so many of them right now are focused on we are separate. I'm going to protest those people. I'm going to break these windows. I'm going to burn this institution. And that by breaking and burning and protesting, you create a new society. Number one, you don't. Doesn't work that way. Number two, if you did create a new society, I wouldn't want to be in it. You haven't given me anything that I am living for. You haven't given me a vision of a world that I actually want to be living in. You haven't shown me that your values are different from the values of the people you're protesting.
There's a lot of historical precedents, though, where ordinary people sort of rose up on their hind legs and said, we can't do this anymore. I mean, you talk about labor issues. That's a perfect example. We have 8-hour days. We have no child labor. I mean, these are ideals. Obviously, we're not perfect at that. But I mean, I think ordinary people rising up and saying enough is enough is something that has to happen. So I can agree with you, you know, that it's not that protesting doesn't have value, because I think it does.
So I want to be clear about this. As a former protester, I was put into a hospital paralyzed from my neck down by a police beating. I don't have any illusions about that. But every protest that worked, the protests that work are fueled by visions. Tell me what your vision is. If you can't tell me what your vision is, just saying, I'm angry, I'm mad, gets you nowhere. So the people who are holding up the signs and saying women should have the right to vote had a vision. Now, they were protesting, but they had a vision. The people, I'm talking about my own leaders and my mentors. You know, Martin Luther King protesting segregation had a vision of the society that he was living in. That if you don't have the vision, just going saying, I'm angry, doesn't get you anywhere.
What do you think, Susan? Does that tie the two things together so we can close down here at this lovely conversation? We used to have an hour show. You would have been perfect for our hour show. Yeah. And it's been really nice having you.
Invite me back twice.
Okay. Yes, that's possible. So we're going to wrap this up because we've got about 24 seconds. So I want to let people know that if they check online on Common Way Institute, they can find out about your books and also the work you're doing currently. And so thank you very much, Mr. Abdullah. And Susan again, Susan Stoner, also an author. And we'll be back here sometime in the future. So be sure and tune in every Monday at 6:00. Labor Radio is on the air. Thank you very much and good day.
Lane and Susan would like to remind you that KBOO is nearly at the end of our spring membership drive, but there's still time to show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button to become a member.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
Nobody told me that You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Hello? Hello? 1, 2, 3.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO, Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening the understanding of the institution of incarceration. Today, we're here with Saadia Durant with the Abolitionist Law Center and a bunch of other great projects, too. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Right on. Thanks for being on. Let's get right into it. Can you talk a bit about how you got involved with the different organizing that you do and also just give some explanation of where you're located?
Cool, yes. So I'm Saadia, she, her pronouns. I'm an organizer, a racial justice organizer with the Abolitionist Law Center here.